And we are joined by a plethora. That's an official quantity of Concorde pilots.
That's right. We are surrounded by guys who have gone supersonic without necessarily being in the military.
Well, I never thought of it like that.
Well, hey, guys, I got to tell you, I saw a Concorde once. I was down in Washington, D.C., and I heard the roar of what sounded like a military aircraft. I looked up, and there she was going over, and I thought to myself, well, doggone, look at that.
Well, you know, they were told to wave at people on the ground, and didn't you see it?
I never saw it. I did wave at you, though.
Now, you need new glasses there, your boss, Eddie.
Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah, you do.
Let's get you up to one that works.
Let's find one that works, yeah.
I actually had the honor of being here in 1989 when the Concorde was here.
88.
And, no.
Yeah.
No.
85 and 88.
Was it 88?
Yeah, get a grip.
I love these guys.
I can see we're going to have fun.
Anyway, been to a bunch of air shows. Never been to an air show where I got to sit on the side of the runway and watch a Concorde take off.
It's pretty cool.
Oh, very cool.
Can I make a correction, please? Because we've two pilots here, Ian and myself. We were both first officers on the fleet. Ian was here in 85 with John Cook. Dave McDonald is the flight engineer, a most important guy on the crew, and he was here both times, 85 and 88.
Okay, so the flight engineer operates the soda dispensers?
That's the one. You got it.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I thought.
He'll fill you in on that one.
Okay. You have to be careful on a takeoff, though, because the engine controls are located right next to the soda dispenser.
Yeah,
you
right
don't
next to the ice button.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said ice. Okay, afterburners.
Now, how long was the Concorde actually in service?
27 years.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That long?
Yeah.
And it was a fleet of what, like 14 aircraft built?
There were 20 built.
That's close.
It's close. No, but they were, as it ended up, there were technically 14 airliners. Air France had 7, and we had 7. And when I was on the fleet, 87 to 93, we were operating all 7, and on a number of occasions operated all 7 on the same day, which is quite a unique feat anyway for that type of aeroplane.
Yeah.
Air France had only 4 operational. They bent one on a heavy landing in Dakar one night, and after some months secretly flew it back to, they did a repair, and it stayed back as a museum piece. They stripped one for spares. We call it Christmas tree, and the president had one. But they weren't doing as much work, you know, supersonically as we were. We had 2 flights a day, every day to New York, and in the early days, 3 flights a week to Washington and Miami. The Top Gun sector, we called it, that one, especially Washington down to Miami.
Now, I mean, obviously, were any of these airplanes used for pure research? I mean, an airplane that large going supersonic was pretty rare.
I think Dave Mack would be the one to answer that one.
Were the airplanes used for research?
Did you ever do research flights where you were nothing but instruments and, you know, trying to figure something out?
Well, sure. In the years between first flight in 69 and certification in 75, there were 6 airplanes doing different jobs of research, fully instrumented, you know, as you can imagine, a bit like the A380 cabin that we've seen here today. And then after entry into service, we did little bits of research because, you know, the environmental people to whom we're very friendly, of course.
Yes, yeah, very friendly.
Very
yes,
friendly.
Indeed, yes.
And, you know, they
love us.
They still are friendly, too.
They thought, well, this chap flies up 50,000 to 60,000 feet. We've often wondered what the atmospheric condition up there is. And the approach is, you know, can you take a package up there for us inside the plane?
So you're saying,
squirty little probe that would stick out into the airstream every so often, sample the atmospheric conditions, load it down to the recorder. So we were doing our bit, you know.
I thought you were going to say you strapped a couple environmentalists to the wing and took them up to 50,000 feet.
That would have been
well,
the fun
then dropped
way.
Them off.
Yeah, would have been a fun flight. Guys, I got a question for you now. The takeoff, obviously, had to be quite a thrill. What was it like when you were sitting in that airplane? You know, you obviously advanced the throttles all the way to full power, and then you light the afterburners. What was it like when those afterburners cut in? How much of a pushback did you really get?
I think the first time you did a takeoff like that, you were just hanging on to it, something you'd never experienced before, certainly if you weren't a military pilot. Definitely felt the surge of power even without the reheats coming on. When the reheats came on a little bit later on during the takeoff run, was that about 80 knots, 100 knots? You were well aware that you were going to get airborne and you were going down the runway pretty quickly. But probably the first takeoff was the most exciting, just a lot of fun.
What was your rotation speed?
You're asking a guy here who stopped flying it in 1986, so I have to make up some of these answers, but around about 180 knots.
Ooh, that's so ripping.
Well, I think most of the speeds are about 30 knots higher than conventional subsonic aircraft.
The uniqueness of Concorde was, in fact, that she
Had afterburners, the only civil airliner that actually used afterburners for takeoff, and we used them for every takeoff, whether it was light or heavy. But at maximum weight takeoff, you didn't notice the acceleration so much. It was just the excitement was that you knew that there would be 1,000 pairs of eyes outside there looking at the aeroplane, and you knew that half of those pairs of eyes would be pilots like me just wishing they'd been in that slot. It is exciting, there's no doubt about it. But the afterburners helped to accelerate the slender Delta aeroplane to her takeoff speed of about 250 miles an hour in the same distance as a jumbo would take. Just a touch noisier than any other aeroplane, so we were very, very, very aware of that, such that the we would have a timing that exactly so many seconds after, usually between 58 seconds and 1 minute 15, the afterburners would be cut out and the power reduced so that the aircraft could quietly, technically, tiptoe out over the countryside, making as minimum noise as possible.
Well, that was one of the big concerns with the Concorde. People were, you know, hey, this thing is big, loud, and noisy. And
oh,
of course,
it's no worse than the DC-8s that used to fly
over.
No,
that's exactly right. You guys were right on par with the 707s and the other commercial airliners of the time. It's just you were having a little more fun than the other guys.
Now, the crop of pilots that flew, were you guys all ex-military? I mean, first off, nobody else could get supersonic experience. Nobody else could get an engine with an afterburner experience. It'd be awfully hard to take a civilian pilot and train him up for that, wouldn't it?
Luckily, no. A lot of the pilots were military. I had quite a lot of military experience. I mean, Tony here obviously has. I didn't. I avoided joining the RAF at the last minute, mainly because they didn't have any aircraft to fly at the time, and I'd have ended up on helicopters, which didn't appeal to me, perhaps mistakenly, but I wanted to be a fast jet pilot, of course, like all young ignorant men. And so I got a degree in engineering and then eventually joined British Airways as a pilot and just happened to be in the right spot to bid for the Concorde fleet. So, yeah, military experience wasn't required, but sense of humor and dedication was.
Well, you know,
the sense of humor comes naturally to you guys.
It does. You know, when you go through pilot training, were you using cockpit simulators like they're doing nowadays? Most of the training on airliners today is done in the simulator. And I've heard stories that very often the first time that a newly minted commercial pilot will go out and actually fly the airliner is the first time they're actually in commercial service. Everything else, including the certifications nowadays, pretty much done in the simulators. Did you guys do the same thing?
To some extent, yes. It was a while back that this aircraft first came into service. When I was on the course, we used actually a lighting mock-up for the panel scans and this sort of thing because the simulator was still in use by the test pilots and development pilots. Then when we got onto the simulator, it was mostly done on the simulator. All the emergency drills, all the high altitude work, that sort of thing was done, and the simulator was really excellent. But one thing it couldn't do was to clear pilots for takeoff and landing. So the base training still had to be touch and go, and we did that at the military airfield, which was a lot more fun. Of course, we got a lot more handling that way.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed about flying the Concorde is the fact that when you guys are coming in for a landing, I mean, you've got this thing wickedly nose high. Did you ever get any passenger complaints because they're thinking, you know, holy moly, we're, you know, it must have felt to them like they were going to roll to the tail of the airplane. Did anybody ever make notice of that?
I don't think so particularly. But no, just picking up on that point about training just for a second, I think the reason the guys, this is the flight engineer speaking incidentally, the reason the guys had to do landings at a military airfield was that this Delta wing flies so differently. Now, the handling on a Delta wing is quite different to the handling on the swept wing subsonic jets that you see. We're flying right on the backside of the drag curve. In other words, as we're reducing speed down the approach, the slower we go, the more power we need. So, in fact, we developed high-speed, we call it a reduced noise approach. We thought that sounded much more sort of airline and user-friendly
yes.
Than a high-speed decelerating approach. The wing characteristics defined the nature of the training.
Well, it just amazes me because of all the pictures that I have seen of the Concorde coming in. You know, a normal commercial airliner doesn't come in like this, and I'm seeing the Concorde, and it's like it looks like it's almost you're almost standing it on the engines coming in, and you know, it had to be something that
they usually did. They usually told the flight attendants to put out all the drinks right before landing, just so that they could spill them on everybody.
No, they had champagne on those flights. I don't think you'd want to be spilling champagne.
One question I had: obviously, you work your way up through the flying, and then you land on the Concorde. Is that the only airplane you fly, or do they transition you back and forth as needed?
Technically, when you think about the what goes on in American airlines, to get promotion, you go from one airplane, you know, you go to first officer, say, on the jumbo, drop down to a captain on something else. In British Airways, we didn't do that. You made a bidding system, and you could bid for any airplane you wanted to fly. You could, for example, fly, you know, just if you wanted short haul, you stayed short haul. To go to the Concorde, there was no special selection, just ordinary. I mean, the idea of Concorde simply was, from the passenger point of view, the difficult part was to make it like an ordinary airliner, because it was two airliners in one, a supersonic airplane and one that flew subsonically. Pilots could bid for it. It didn't matter who you were. It's just that the course was really hard. 2 months for a jumbo, 6 months for a Concorde one, even longer for the engineers. They had to do the, quote, secrets course as well. That would be another month to 2 months as well. So it really was quite, you know, it's quite an arduous course, and people didn't want to go on the airplane. Particularly, they wanted to fly it. They didn't want the job, which is just in New York and back in Washington and a few special charters around the world. You made more money by flying the jumbo than you did by flying the Concorde. This was love and dedication, skill and daring, basically.
What was that line from Top Gun? You just weren't happy unless your hair on fire was hair on your hair was on fire.
Going
and you're
Mach
going Mach 2
with your hair on fire. Right. There it is. Yeah,
absolutely.
And don't forget, we carry the girls with us.
Yeah.
You know, over the years, you know, Concorde being a very special aircraft, you know, as the airplane aged, you know, how was maintenance on this airplane? Did it start to get maintenance intensive, or was it, you know,
it just
pretty
took
decent?
More quarters to keep it flying.
Honest to God.
I don't have a degree in astrophysics, but as I understand it, the faster you accelerate towards the speed of light, the younger you get. So our airplanes didn't actually age that quickly. No, we only ran about 1,200 hours a year.
For a commercial airliner, that's not much.
No, you should be doing at least four times that amount. So we were sort of striking a balance between utilization and sort of preservation, you know, keep them flying. But no, they were good. They were good airplanes. One thing in particular was that you must have read or heard that at those high speeds, Mach 2, the structure gets up to about 130 degrees centigrade. It was the same with the B-58, and on the SR-71, even more. So all that nasty liquid stuff, the spills, the condensation, boiled off. It evaporated. So you got very little corrosion. Which is a bugbear for maintenance engineers and structural life. What we did suffer from a bit is that temperature. It would harden the fuel tank ceiling, and when the fuselage stretched, you know, you heat up an aluminum, isn't it? Aluminum cylinder.
Yes, aluminium.
Oh, I know. I've been to language school. Yes. Metal expands, doesn't it?
Yes.
And the Concorde did. And so you've got hardened sealant. You stretch it and back again, and it cracks quite easily. The SR-71 was the same.
Oh, it was famous for that.
Yeah. So most maintenance problems were derived from that high temperature, heat, and the associated vibration we had.
So you're saying that as you're doing the pre-flight, there was a check on there, fuel tank leaking check. If it wasn't leaking, it was
that
empty,
is
right?
Not too far from the truth, you know. We had strategies in place, and it worked well.
Well, there you go.
It's the old story. If it's not leaking, it's because it's empty. You better check it.
And we didn't like empty.
No, not good. At all. Not
especially in the coffee pot.
Well, you guys were flying at what? Between like 50 and 60,000 feet. Did you guys? Well, you had to do night flights in that. Concorde. What was it like flying supersonic in the dark?
It was, I guess, dark. It was about the same as it was flying supersonic in the light.
You didn't see anything special or unusual at night.
Thunderstorms? You did see things. Well, they were all below us in theory.
That had to be
when
wild.
when we started on the airplane back in 76. High speed sustained flight around about 60,000 feet had never been seen before. People had been up there, obviously, but not for long periods. In fact, since we left, nobody's been up there for long periods either, because nobody can do what we did, which is fly up there for 3 hours without refueling, without coming down for fuel. So when it was an unknown area, and I remember the experts saying, and you know what experts are like.
Yeah, yeah.
The wind won't blow up there. The temperature is constant, and there were no clouds, so nothing to worry about.
Right.
Well, I've flown round clouds at 60,000 feet, which were still above me. The wind at 100 miles an hour, and the temperature 20 degrees different to what it was further down. So the atmosphere does change. It's a movable thing. So when you're up there, you're in a strange atmosphere. But the best thing is, because of the speed, you're moving through the sky quicker than the sun is moving through the sky.
Jeez, that's
so if
intense.
You take off heading west after the sun has set, now don't forget the sun sets in the west.
Right.
So you're taking off after it now, chasing it across the sky. And then after you've been going a little while, the sun rises again in the west. And you land then in daylight, and then the sun sets again in the west. So you get two sunsets for the price of one. So we gave you real value for money.
Yes, that's a feature.
And of course, because the local time is based on the movement of the sun, we would arrive local time before we took off from the other end. So we gave you time travel, which meant if you're going to New York, you could have breakfast in London, breakfast on the aeroplane, and you arrived in Manhattan just in time for breakfast.
Oh, jeez.
Or, of course, you had the traffic jams in London getting to the airport and the traffic jams in Manhattan as well getting in from the airport there. So we gave you real value for money in all of that.
I was going to say, if you've ever been in Manhattan, you'd discover that the traffic jams really never go away.